Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Powerful Patient. I'm Joyce Graff and I'm delighted to have you with me today. Today we're going to talk about courage, and courage comes in many, many forms. And life is not always roses, so we all have some difficult times to go through, and the courage with which we face those challenges is what tempers us and what makes us who we are. This show is brought to you each week by the VHL Family Alliance. Von Hippel-Lindau disease is a hereditary cancer syndrome, and I'd like to play you a little bit of information about VHL. The show focuses on issues of interest to people with complex medical conditions or disabilities, and I think that you'll find something here of interest to almost everyone at some point. So please listen now to some information about VHL, and then we'll be back to speak with our guest.
Von Hippel-Lindau disease, or VHL, is a genetic condition involving abnormal growth of tumors in some parts of the body. VHL occurs in every ethnic group worldwide. At this time, there's no cure, but research is helping those afflicted and their families learn how to manage their disease. When a family member has a tumor, it affects everyone in the family. VHL Alliance works to improve diagnosis, treatment, and the quality of life. Finding tumors early, getting the best treatment, and sharing information with others to help them cope is what VHL Alliance is all about. They're available to help lessen the stress of living with this lifetime chronic disease. Support the Cancer Research Fund of the VHL Alliance at VHL.org. That's Very Happy Life, VHL.org. 1-800-767-4-VHL.
Great. Glad to have you with us, and I hope you'll explore our website at vhl.org. And the transcripts of these shows and the recordings from these shows are held at powerfulpatient.org. So you'll find this show there and lots of other things of interest. Today's guest is David G. Hallman. Hello, David.
Hello, Joyce.
Welcome. Glad to have you with us today.
Thank you. I'm glad to be on your show.
Thanks. David has a new book called August Farewell. And, David, this is a beautifully poignant book. Tell us a little bit about why you wrote this book.
Sure. The book is a memoir, primarily, of the 16 days between the diagnosis that we received for my partner of pancreatic cancer, stage 4, in August of 2009, and 16 days later, his death on August the 23rd. And it interweaves in the chronology of those 16 days vignettes from our life together. We were together as a gay couple for 33 years, and I've tell basically the story of our many aspects of our life together over that period.
That's great, it's certainly beautifully done. You have other books, too, that you had written on the ethics and environmental ethics. What is environmental ethics exactly?
Yes, I worked for many years for the United Church of Canada on the national staff, and the United Church is the largest Protestant denomination in Canada, and also on the staff simultaneously of the World Council of Churches based in Geneva. And for both, I had responsibility for environmental ethics, which is a concern about caring for God's creation and the kinds of actions that we need to take as the human community to preserve and sustain the God's creation, and with a particular emphasis on the fact that many of the threats to the environment come from highly industrialized countries with our large and high consuming lifestyles and economies, but the impacts will be suffered most by those least able to handle them, the poor in developing countries and around the world. So that was a lot of the work that I did, but then I retired a number of years ago, and shortly after that, Bill, my partner, started to manifest symptoms of that something was going on, and then was diagnosed with cancer.
Right. So, go ahead.
The books that I wrote before were books related to my professional work, but this August Farewell, as you noted, is a very different kind of book. And I wrote it after he died because that experience of him dying was just so intense and powerful and profound and on so many different levels that mm-hmm. I wanted to record that so I didn't forget it. The details of that intense experience. So it is a very significant departure as a book from anything else that I've ever written.
Right. And it certainly was a very dramatic and intense time. As you say, 16 days from diagnosis to death is pretty abrupt.
It is. And that's fairly unusual, except it's not unknown in the area of pancreatic cancer. Apparently pancreatic cancer, and I've learned a fair amount since this experience, is one of the more difficult forms of cancer to diagnose. And even though we were getting lots of tests done because Bill was having more pain and fatigue in the preceding months, the tests didn't show the nature of or the source of the problem until quite late, and that's also not that unusual for pancreatic cancer. Apparently, it's hard to detect, and when it does manifest itself in the test, like a CAT scan, then it's often fairly far progressed.
So how long did he have the pain and other symptoms that now in retrospect you realized were foreshadowings of the pancreatic cancer?
It was for several months before, but there was a compounding variable in that he had had multiple sclerosis for 30 years. Within about 6 months of our having met and started living together as a couple, he was diagnosed with MS, and so he had fatigue and pain all his life. And when in the spring of 2009 he was having increased pain and increased fatigue, we initially assumed that it was another MS attack or something along that lines. But he was very conscientious about going to his doctor and getting all tests that were possible, and still nothing showed up abnormal that would suggest that it was something other than pancreatic cancer, or that it was something other than the MS, until finally the CAT scan on August the 9th, August the 7th.
Right, and only a matter of months before all this came to a head. So it's another good example of how sneaky pancreatic cancer can be, and it really doesn't show its colors until it's very far advanced.
That certainly was our experience, and I don't want to generalize for others, but that was certainly our experience. And once it was diagnosed, once it did show up on the CAT scan, it was already in the lymph nodes in the liver, and there were spots in the lungs that had metastasized quite rapidly. And then during the 16 days, he deteriorated very rapidly, which suggests that it was moving very, very voraciously through his system.
Right. So most of the people who are diagnosed with pancreatic cancer and also with kidney cancer are diagnosed fairly late in the game because the symptoms don't show up until then, unless it's some sort of incidental finding or if you happen to know that you have some familial risk factors, for example, that might indicate that you ought to keep an eye out. So people with von Hippel-Lindau, for example, know that they're at risk for kidney or pancreatic cancer, and so we go looking early and hopefully find the tumors when they're smaller and easier to deal with. But after this very intense experience, I can understand why you would want to write this out, if only for your own self. What made you decide to publish it and go public with it?
I did write it for myself, as you say, and when I was finished with it, I thought, well, I'll share it with some close friends who were very close to Bill and followed those 16 days very closely and were very supportive of us, and they might appreciate reading it. And as they read it and then passed it on to others, I kept getting a regular kind of feedback from people saying, this is really a story that a lot of people could benefit from reading, David. You need to make this more widely available. And I resisted taking any steps to do that for almost a year, because it is a very private story. But the consistency with which I kept getting this message, both that it could be helpful to people facing crises like this in their lives, and then comparable message that sort of was parallel to that, people were saying, as we read this and read about your life together as a couple, what we take away from it primarily is not the depressing nature of the death, but the vibrancy of the love that the two of you had. And it's basically a love story. I kept being told this was really a love story. Mm-hmm. And so it convinced me that yes, there is a positive message that people are saying that needs to be shared with others.
That's right, and that, you know, two people who love each other and can build that kind of supportive relationship together is a wonderful thing. There aren't a whole lot of them, so that's an achievement in itself.
And yes, and one of the things that really pushed me over that obstacle that I had imposed about taking more public were the series of suicides last September of young gay people who were subject to bullying and to homophobia, and then arose a campaign called It Gets Better to try and convince young people that it is possible to find love in your life and it is possible to have a wonderful life together with a partner. And that was a comparable message that I kept getting from people saying, this kind of story of this kind of love needs to be shared, and you should take it more public.
Yes, thank you. It's great that you did that. And whether it's two women, two men, a man and a woman, creating that kind of loving bond and supportive environment between two people is something that takes a lot of work that not everybody is willing to work at, is willing to create, and is really unique in many ways.
I'm always of two minds on the question of relationships take work. I agree with that it's that you have to invest time and energy, and communication is always very important. But my personal life experience was that this person that I met, we just, if one can believe in love at first sight, that's what we experienced. We were living together within a week or two of having met, and it was a kind of a relationship that sort of took off and just was and lived at a very full and joyful and intense life for 33 years, even though we had major challenges, obviously. If Bill was diagnosed with multiple sclerosis 6 months into it, it wasn't that we had an easy life, but we were just so much in love that in the sense of working at it, that's not my memory of it. We were just so glad to be in each other's company, and glad that we had found each other, that we were building this time together and building this life together.
Right, and I'm trying to think how to characterize it. You probably have better words for this than I do, but some sort of each person has to have the intention of making it work. And my grandmother used to say each partner has to give 80%, you know, that that there will be wrinkles in the road. There will be things that you disagree on. But if you approach it with the intention of we can work this out, you're much more likely to succeed than if you say, no, I want it my way.
Oh, yes. And one of the dominant characteristics, I think, that influenced how we related to each other was that we were so much in love. We really wanted, and I don't mean this to sound presumptuous, but we really wanted the best for the other. And so if there were compromises that needed to be made, we were prepared to do that if it meant that it met a need or desire on the part of the other. And that certainly then became a factor when we got the diagnosis of pancreatic cancer. The primary determinant for me at that point was, what does Bill want? And what Bill wanted was to exit life gracefully, quietly, with as much of a quality of life at that point as we could arrange.
So many of us are brought up to believe that there's a happily ever after. And I think what I'm hearing you say is that there's a happily, but it's not a bump-free road. If you have the right intentions and the right attitude about things, that you can make the road smoother for the two of you and have a happy life, even though there will be challenges.
Yes, and it helps in that we shared many kinds of interests and similar values. In some ways, we were very different from each other, but we were both very strong personalities, and we constantly kind of sparked life force in each other, if you want. And we had common interests. We were interested in music and art and travel and people and social justice and environmental justice. He was a musician. Worked in, as I said, in the environmental ethics field, but we both shared a very strong faith. Church was very important to us, and having those commonalities, opening up experiences that we could share together, meant that it was a very rich and interesting life that we were able to build together.
Right, faith and spirituality and the arts and travel. You mentioned, too, that the both of you cared for your aging parents, and I know a lot of people in gay relationships have issues with even communicating with their parents, much less taking care of their parents. Just sort of tell us how a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was a major factor in our lives in the latter years as our parents aged. Bill was an only child, so he had no siblings. And we invited his parents as they retired to come and live with us. So we had a house in Stratford, Ontario, which is a small town west of Toronto. It's where the Stratford Shakespeare Festival is. It's a really interesting community. And we invited his parents, as they started to manifest some health problems, to come and live with us there so we could care for them. My parents were in a town nearby, Kitchener-Waterloo, which is where I grew up. And as they aged, I was the primary person to support them. I have two brothers, but they were both living in the United States. And so for both Bill and I, we were the people to provide the support for our parents. Certainly, in families where there's a gay son or daughter, it isn't always a smooth and easy road. And so there were challenges, but it was very important to care for our parents, and they repeatedly indicated how much they were appreciating that support as they were aging. So it was really a good relationship in those years.
That's great. It sounds like there was a lot of good humor, too, a good sense of humor, and Bill was cracking jokes even at the end with the hospital staff.
Oh, yes, yes. He had a wicked sense of humor, and he was always telling jokes. He was a wonderful joke teller, and he was a constant practical joke teller as well, and I was often on the receiving end of those practical jokes. But it was he was a very we had a cottage at one point, and we used to go up there a lot in the winter time, and we had a lot of birds that would come, and chickadees in particular were prevalent, and he would love feeding the chickadees out of his hand, put some seed in his hand, and this was wonderful. I enjoyed it as well, but the birds always came to him and they never came to me, and he always, for years, he would joke and he would tell my friends that obviously it's because he, Bill, has a pure heart, and the birds can sense this, and that's why they come to him and not to the seed in my hand, when in fact he had peppered his seed in his hand with sunflower seeds, which were much more attractive to the chickadees. And I didn't know this for years and years, and always felt somewhat diminished that somehow the nature that I was thinking that I was taking so much good care of through my professional work wasn't responding in kind, and it was loving him. And there were regular kinds of incidents like that he would pull.
Yeah, you said that at one point. I wonder if he's telling the technician the dead duck joke. What was the dead duck joke?
The dead duck joke. Yes, this was a very strange part of this day when we went into the emergency department for this whole battery of tests that his doctor had recommended that we have, to include the CAT scan. And we went into the X-ray, and he said, "Oh, before we start the X-ray, I've got this wonderful joke that I need to tell you. And here's this all this high-priced technology sitting here, and the technician is all ready to do the X-ray, and she's kind of taken back by saying, 'I've got a joke for you.' And she says, 'Oh,' but then she says, 'Okay, tell me your joke.' So he goes on into this joke, and it's about a woman who goes to her veterinarian with a duck, and she says to the veterinarian, I think my duck is dead. Can you examine it?' And the veterinarian looks at this duck, and it's clearly dead. And he says, 'Yeah, lady, your duck is dead.' And she says, 'What? That's not a very good examination. I want a more detailed exam.' And so he says, 'Oh, okay.' And he opens one door, and a cat comes walking in, and he motions to the duck, and the cat jumps up on the examining table and starts sniffing around the duck. And then the cat looks at the vet and shakes its head, and the vet says, 'Oh, I guess that concludes that the duck is dead.' And the woman says, 'That's crazy. That doesn't make sense.' And he says, 'Okay, I'll give you more tests.' And so he opens another door, and a Labrador Retriever comes rambling in and gets up on the examining table, sniffs the duck, and shakes his head at the veterinarian. And the woman is just aghast at this, and she said, 'This is crazy. Give me the bill. I want to get out of here. You're absurd.' And so he says, 'Okay,' and he types up the bill and gives her the bill, and it's $350. And she says, 'What for telling me my duck is dead?' And he said, 'Well, it would have been a lot less expensive if you had just allowed me for my assessment, but you wanted the CAT scan and you wanted the lab report, so that's what beefed up the cost.'" And of course, he had to tell this because of the X-ray technician, and she thought it was just hysterical. And meanwhile, I'm standing there, anxious that all this important equipment and this tight schedule that this hospital is running under is having to be put on hold while my lover tells the technician the dead duck joke.
That's a great one. So, I mean, we're enjoying the light side of this, but obviously this was a pretty dark time for the two of you. And so tell us a little bit about how the how this diagnosis was delivered and the thought process that the two of you went through in deciding how you were going to carve out the path for the next few weeks.
The diagnosis was delivered just in such a sympathetic and empathic and professional way. We're very proud of our healthcare system here in Canada, and we experienced, Bill and I experienced it at its best all through this process. And so we got all these tests. We were at the hospital. We got all these tests, and the doctor came in and she said, "I'm very, very sorry to tell you that this is very, very bad news." And she outlined it to us. She was very candid, but she was very empathic with us. And all through this day-long series of tests at the hospital, we were always treated very respectfully as a couple. I was always involved in all the conversations, which I was very appreciative of. And then Bill and I, and she said, "Do you want me to admit you now at this point?" And Bill and I had talked in the previous few days because his situation was getting so much more distressful, even though we didn't know the source of it, that if there was something serious, what were we going to do? And he and we and I were both very convinced that we wanted him at home if it was a really traumatic situation. So we came home, and very quickly a system was geared up to provide us with the in-home care that we needed. So they brought a hospital bed in to our home. Palliative care doctors came. We had nurses coming every day. Homemakers came to help me bathe him, and all the medical supplies that we needed, up to and including the morphine pump. But all of that we had in our home, which made the quality of that end of life period so much for us, so much better than if we had had to go through that in a institutionalized hospital setting.
Right, and whenever we get a difficult diagnosis, and he'd had a difficult diagnosis once before too with the MS and so forth, and we always have to decide, okay, what are we going to do about this? Can we make the situation better? Is there a treatment that's going to help? What accommodations do we need to keep life fairly normal, etc.? And then when you come to a diagnosis like the stage 4 pancreatic cancer that clearly was at a pretty intense pitch when this news was delivered, then we go through that same thought process. Can we make it better? And in this case, the options are very limited. What kinds of options were you given that you at least gave some thought to before you decided to go home?
We were given consultations with chief oncologists, and they were prepared to go through the series of options that were possible. I had asked the emergency room doctor when she first delivered the results of stage 4. I said, "You saying that this is basically an inoperable situation?" And I couldn't believe that I was saying those words, because I was saying verbally for the first time, "My partner, his number's up. Is this what you're telling us?" And she said, "Yes, it's." And she again, she was very calm and sympathetic, but she said, "Yes, this has progressed so far that surgery is not really a viable option, but we can look at a series of other kinds of options, and the chief oncologist can give you the best advice for that, and we can set up appointments for that," which we did. But then after we came home, Bill started deteriorating very quickly, and he wasn't anymore having the strength for us to go back to the hospital for those consultations. So I actually had those consultations on the phone with the chief oncologist, and those options were there for us, but we had decided, and in particular Bill had decided, he was ready to go, and he wanted to go quietly and peacefully without a lot of invasive apparatus or procedures.
Right, and when you get into a situation like that, sometimes there are new medications that you can try that might extend life by a matter of weeks or maybe months at the most, but it's a difficult course, and so there's always a choice. Do I really want to fight that hard, spend that much time, anguish, and money fighting, or do I want to just say, you know what, it's been a great run, but I think this is the end?
Yes, and there was something else that was very pivotal in our experience, which certainly I don't want to generalize to other people's experience, but after
sure.
we came home from the hospital, Bill went to bed, had to rest, and had this incredible dream and woke up about an hour later just laughing, and I went rushing into the bedroom because I didn't know what was happening, and he said, I just had this incredible dream. He said, you won't believe it. He said, I've dreamt that I was walking in a garden with Jesus, and we were joking back and forth, we were convincing back and forth. Jesus told me how good looking I was looking, and he said, Bill recounting the dream, he said, Jesus told me, I'm ready for you, everything is fine, you're going to be coming soon, don't worry, you'll be out of this pain soon, I'm waiting for you. And then Bill woke up from this dream, and he was just glowing as he was recounting this dream. And so for him, that clinched it. There was no sense of fighting this or prolonging it. He had been in a lot of pain for weeks, and he was ready to go into a place that was painless. And
right.
So with him being so peaceful and reconciled to it, I needed to put on an act that I was prepared for him to go to, even though I wasn't in that same place.
Right. He may have been ready to go, but you weren't necessarily ready to let him go, right? So.
Very much, yeah, very much. But it was interesting. Having gone through the experience with our parents, as each of them died, and we were with them all, the four of them, in the latter stages, and including in the last weeks and last days and last hours and minutes, we had already had an experience of the end of life. And I think those experiences, in all the cases except for Bill's mom, it was a kind of traumatic experience. She had congestive heart failure, and she had a very uncomfortable few days just before she died. But then she got to a point where she also wanted the respirator to be taken out, and she wanted to die peacefully. So having had that experience and knowing that Bill wanted to go quietly, even though I wanted him for another 33 years or even 33 days, what I wanted was not what needed to happen. What needed to happen was to make these last days the best possible, as good as could be, for my partner who I loved so much.
Right. Let's talk a little bit about the word palliative care, because some people hear that word and they think, oh, that means we're giving up. That means I've admitted that he's dying. And sometimes, even earlier in the process, palliative care can be very helpful in helping to manage pain, helping to support the family. What was your experience of palliative care?
Our experience was excellent. And as a function of having published August Farewell, I've become connected to quite a network of palliative care doctors and nurses and professionals throughout the U.S. In particular and in Canada, and have learned more about the struggles in their profession because, yes, as you introduced this theme, you're right, for some in the medical profession and in the broader society to talk about the end of life and to talk about palliative care, making that end of life as peaceful and as comfortable as possible for the patient who's dying, that bespeaks of giving up, or that bespeaks of a failure on the part of the medical profession to sustain life for some people. And palliative care doctors have a very difficult time in, and nurses in the profession, because their role is not to use extreme measures unless the patient and the family wants it, but their role is primarily to help minimize the amount of pain that the person experiences, maximize the amount of comfort that the person is in, so that what appears to be a very inevitable death, which certainly for us it was an inevitable death, can be one that is as free of stress as is possible for the patient who is dying. And that's what palliative care is intended for, to help that exiting, which is going to be inevitable for all of us, mm-hmm. but when it's inevitable, to help that exiting from life to be as graceful and as pain-free as possible.
Right, just as we hope for an easy birth for a new baby, we also have to hope for an easy death and transitioning to the next chapter, whatever that may be in our belief systems. But it's those ins and outs in life that can be traumatic or it can be eased. And we have a lot of knowledge now in the medical profession that can help to ease that time. But palliative care can also be used as a supplement to people going through chemotherapy, for example. Sometimes there are terrible side effects, and the skills and medications that are used in palliative care can help you feel better. I think that's sort of the definition of the term, right, is to palliate, to make it feel better.
That's correct. I was on an internet chat last night with a whole network of palliative care doctors and nurses and professionals in the field, and also cancer groups. And it's a really delicate balance for doctors about how to broach this, when to broach this with patients, at what stage, and the conversations then that go on between the professionals and the patients. And for some patients and for some families, they don't want to hear that this is inevitable. They don't want to hear any kind of discussion about end of life or palliative care. They want only to talk about possible cures or possible ways of sustaining life. Others are in a different place and are in the kind of place that we were, and that makes it easier for those kinds of conversations to occur. But it is quite a challenge for professionals in the field to broach that issue and know how early in the discussions to start it, and so that people know what their options are and to gauge what the resistance is or the openness to those conversations.
Right, and I've been reading a lot about cancer lately. I've read the Emperor of All Maladies, which is a wonderful book about cancer, if anybody's interested. It's a lot of technical detail, but one of the things he says in there is that maybe we need to redefine success in cancer, because we're not always going to win this battle. We're not always going to find a cure. Every one of us is going to check out of this life at some point. That is inevitable. And exactly how that end of life occurs is, in many cases now, up to us. It's like more than half of people who die in hospitals die because they turned off the machines. So we're getting to the point of almost having to make some decisions about how the end of our lives is going to play out. And doing death with dignity is sometimes hard to accomplish, especially if you die in a hospital.
That's right, and that's one of the things that I am forever grateful for in our experience. Once we had decided that we wanted Bill at home, there was a whole network of services that were immediately geared up for us. As I said, the physical necessities like a hospital bed so that it was easier to move him and care for him all the way through to the morphine pump, and then the personnel who were coming, was all coordinated seamlessly from my experience as the primary caregiver. One of the things that I know there are efforts here in where I live in Canada to increase is the option for people to have that end of life stage in their home, in their familiar surroundings. So to increase the mobility of services for in-home care, to increase the expertise that can support the primary caregivers, it has a huge, for us, a huge quality of life difference than being in an institution. For some people, it's not an option. If one were, for instance, I think of a very elderly couple, and they were both quite frail, it might be quite difficult for the one partner to be cared for at home if the other partner was equally frail. So obviously hospitals are the only option for some people, but increasing numbers of people would prefer to die at home. And at least in Canada, I don't know the situation as well in the States, but the system seems to be gearing up to allow that to happen.
Right. One thing that I wanted people to be sure to hear, though, is that even in this extreme situation that you all were thrust into, you did have the options of going to clinical trials or surgery or whatever. The Canadian system was definitely offering you the choice there, right? Because I think a lot of Americans have the vision that the Canadian system is somehow withholding certain kinds of care from people who are in extreme situations or for people who are elderly. Could you talk a little about that for us, please?
You're absolutely right. We had absolutely all the options presented to us. They were limited in their efficacy given the stage of the diagnosis. But if we had wanted anything, it would have been available to us. Those decisions were ours to make as the patient and the family. No one else was making it for us, and the system was prepared to go to any lengths that we wanted to provide the kind of assistance that we felt was appropriate and that we wanted to pursue. We were definitely the ones in the driver's seat, and we wanted what we chose, an in-home quiet, palliative care.
And I think that each one of us really needs to put some thought into that. I mean, we don't like to think about death, but on the other hand, we need to communicate with our families, with our partners, with our friends if we don't have a partner. Somebody else needs to know and maybe even have the right to sign if we can't, to say, okay, this is the way I want the end of my life to go. Either I want all the heroic measures, you know, until I breathe my last, I want every heroic measure. Or, you know, if I get to the point where I can't do A, B, and C, then I would really like to just quietly and gracefully exit stage right.
That's right. And there are important and not very complicated legal documents that would allow that. They're called advanced directives, which specify your wishes. For me, one of the motivations for publishing August Farewell was to encourage people to have those kind of conversations early. Because you're right, we are all going to die, and to have those kind of conversations with our parents or with our partner or whoever we're close to about what our wishes are, and not to exist longer and longer and longer towards the end in that kind of denial that it's going to happen, that can make a huge difference, both for the experience of the person who is dying and for the experience of the family. Yes. I've had some people who have read August Farewell who have told me, I wish I'd read your story earlier, because with my mother, they tell me, we kept pretending that this wasn't happening, and we missed out on the opportunity to both decide about how that would happen and even to have the conversations about saying our goodbyes. And as difficult as that is, that was just hugely important to Bill and me. And I talk about a fair amount in the book about, or relate in the book, our process of saying our goodbyes to each other. And that, having had that opportunity, having taken that opportunity, leaves me as the survivor in such a different state than if I hadn't had the opportunity to say my goodbyes to him, or him have the opportunity to say his goodbyes to me.
Right, right. Well, and I think particularly if someone's in the position of having to sign the papers to turn off the machines in the hospital, that can be very wrenching. If you feel like, I'm making this decision on behalf of her, am I really doing the right thing, versus I'm doing this because my mother wants it this way.
And that was the case exactly for Bill and his mom. She, because of the congestive heart failure, had, was in the hospital for the last week, and she had a resuscitator, I think that's the name of it, the tube mm-hmm. going down your throat to pump oxygen into the lungs. Terribly, for her, terribly, terribly uncomfortable. She wanted it out. They actually had to, in the ICU, the intensive care unit, they had to strap her arms down to the side of the bed because she would try and pull it out if she wasn't restrained. And this was terrible for her. She was fully cognizant. It was terrible for Bill and for me. It was gut-wrenching for Bill to see her so uncomfortable,
sure.
to see her like this. And she made it very clear to him, to Bill, that she wanted it out. She was ready to die. She had had a good life. And he resisted taking the steps that you just described for another 2 days, because he knew that once it was removed, it would be a matter of hours. But finally, he was persuaded that this is what she wanted, and did that. And then she was moved. She was in the hospital, and she was moved then to the palliative care ward. And within 5 hours, she died. But she died a lot more at peace than if
right.
she had gone at the ICU. And as a result, Bill's memory of that ending was more peaceful. But it was still gut-wrenching for him to have to make that decision and to live with having made that decision.
Right. And so that if we sign those papers in advance, we're doing that favor to our loved ones by giving them the peace of mind, knowing that they're carrying out our wishes and not making a decision that they don't know if we would agree with. So
okay.
I would encourage everybody to do that thinking yourself and then share that with your loved ones. That's very important. David, this has been a delightful conversation. I really appreciate your writing this book and sharing it with us. It's really been very powerful, and I hope that everybody gains a lot from reading it. Again, the book is called August Farewell, and it's by David G. Hallman, and you can find out more at davidghallman.com, and this is with the major booksellers too, I think, right?
Yeah, it has just come out, so bookstores aren't stocking it yet, but any bookstore can order it, and it's easily accessible online through Amazon.com or BarnesandNoble.com. Type in August Farewell in the search line, and it comes up immediately.
Great. I understand you have a novel coming out soon.
I do. I'm in the final stages of writing that. Yes, Searching for Gilead. It will be out later this year. I've found, precipitated by writing this memoir, I found a different kind of voice to write in now beyond the more academic books that I did before, but still dealing with some of the same issues. The novel will still deal with issues of love and loss, and it's a family story. So I'm still there dealing with those issues in my own heart and in my own mind, and writing is the way that I can creatively try and struggle with those.
Well, thank you so much for sharing this wonderful love story with us and helping us to think constructively about not only how we live and love through our lives, but also the end-of-life issues that are so difficult for all of us. And thank you again for joining us today. Anything else you'd like to add to before we sign off?
And just to thank you for a very sympathetic and hospitable conversation and interviewing style. I appreciate it very much. This is a tough story, and I appreciate your sensitivity.
Thank you. And thank you, everybody, for being with us. I hope you'll be with us again next week. Well, actually, next week I'm taking off, because next week I'll be in Houston at a conference for people with von Hippel-Lindau disease. But the week after that, we'll be back with another show. And I hope that you will all be well and be a powerful patient. Thank you.